Welcome to the Maine Historical Society podcast. These podcasts explore the experiences of Maine people in a changing world and the connections between local, state, and national history. To learn more about our programs, please visit us online at www.mainehistory.org/programs.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to Maine Historical Society. I'm Kathleen Newman. I'm the manager of education here, and I want to welcome you to this evening's program. Lisa Brooks is an associate professor of English and American Studies at Amherst and the author of Our Beloved Kin, A New History of King Philip's War, which is available for sale in the Maine Historical Society Museum store. Her first book, The Common Pot, The Recovery of Native Space in the Northeast, received the Media Ecology Association's Dorothy Lee Award for Outstanding Scholarship in the Ecology of Culture in 2011. Although deeply rooted in her Abenaki homeland, Brooks's work has been widely influential in a global network of scholars. She served as the inaugural counsel of the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association and currently serves on the editorial boards of SAIL and Ethnohistory. She also works on the advisory board of Gedanika. Did I say that right? I probably didn't. Gedanika, sorry. A nonprofit organization focused on indigenous cultural revitalization, traditional ecological knowledge, and community wellness in New England. So please join me, folks, in welcoming Lisa Brooks this evening.
Inda Luizi, Lisa Brooks, Ndaye Wabanaki, Ndaye Pemajawaset, Thomas Escoy, Niga Wes. Yao Kosharava, Ulioni Wabanakiak, Ulioni Kaskoak, Ulioni Polin. My name's Lisa Brooks, and my family, my father's family, is from Wabanaki here, the land of the Dawn. We're from Missisquoi, which is in northern Vermont, and Pemajawasset, which is in northern New Hampshire. And my mother's family is from Koszorowa, Poland. So as my little sister said, when she had to do one of those projects, you know, in elementary school where you have to do your family tree, she said, "Well, my dad's family has been here forever, and my mom's family just got here yesterday." And I think it's both of my family's stories, really, that motivated me, I realized, in writing this, to really dig deep into these stories, difficult stories of war. And I want to, before I start talking about the book, just acknowledge that we're in Wabanaki country, and I want to acknowledge my Wabanaki relatives here in Maine, and I also want to acknowledge that we're in the homeland of Kaskwak, and I especially, I know Bill out there will join with me in this, want to acknowledge that this is Poland's homeland and celebrate his legacy here. So let me begin by talking to you just briefly about this first slide here, because this for me encapsulates the three kind of main frameworks of this book, Our Beloved Kin. And that is because there were three archives that I drew on for this book. And one is archives like this phenomenal place here, the Maine Historical Society. And I want to do a huge shout out to this place and to people like Bill and Nick, who were here when I came here and helped be my guide through this place, but also just to say thank you for taking care of the incredible treasure that is here. This book, more than any other archive, this book could not exist without the Maine Historical Society. And a lot of people don't realize how much is here. So archives like this, where you find these documents that may have sat somewhere for hundreds of years, but people haven't quite gotten a handle on what they mean and how significant some of them are. But also, I couldn't understand those kinds of documents without these other two archives, and that's the Archive of the Land. I've learned a lot from going out and walking and trekking through marshes and going on paddles, oftentimes with tribal historians or community members who either know the places well themselves or know how to read the places. And that's something that I learned when I was a young woman and when I was a girl, really, about how to read places. But there's also ways that we can't understand the history unless we understand the places. And that includes the place names. And so language, indigenous language, is the other archive that I draw on. And I'm not a fluent speaker. I probably never will be. I've been a student of the Abenaki language for 20 years, and I think I'm likely to be a student for the rest of my life. But sometimes just understanding some of the concepts that can help us to understand, for example, what peace means, what peacemaking means in the languages of this land, or very particular place names, what they mean and what it tells us about the identity of places and how they were important to people and people's subsistence and survival. And sometimes it is going big picture with concepts from native languages, like this one here, Odzmowogan, which is our word for history. And that tells us, that ending, Wongan, tells us that history is an activity in which we are engaged. It tells us history is a telling, a collective telling that we are doing. So it's not something that can be contained, it's not a subject, it's not just about trying to figure out what happened in the past, but it's something that we're doing. And that's what I'm doing here tonight, right? We're gonna be engaged in this activity tonight. Okay, so there, in this book, there are four main paths. And if anybody has a handle on the tech, there's a little, besides my daughter back there, the tech genius, there's a little bit of an edge that's off here. So if there's any way we can fix the screen, maybe we can do that. But it won't stop us from understanding the places I'm going to show you. The book, Our Beloved Kin, focuses on four main paths. One is Wiedemu, who is the song squaw, or the female leader, the rock woman, of Wampanoag country, who was both an incredible diplomat and also an alliance builder during the war. She was a more formidable leader, some people thought, than King Philip himself. And then also the story of James Printer, who was a convert. He was from a convert family from Hassinamisit, which is Nipmuc territory, but he also worked the press at the Harvard Indian College. And so some of the book recovers that history and the incredible story of what happened to James Printer and his brothers during the war and how their family was kind of torn apart by it. And then a very well-known person, Mary Rowlandson, who of course wrote the first captivity narrative here in New England, which you can see on the screen. And what I do in the book is really kind of flip the script on her captivity narrative and look at the people that she traveled with and the places that she traveled so that we can get a deeper understanding, not just of her journey, but the journey of Wiedemu, who was her mistress, with whom she traveled through all of these places. But the fourth strand, as much as I was taken and absorbed by these stories, the fourth strand may be the one that's the closest to my heart. And it's the one I'm gonna focus on today because it's the one, the story of the Northern Front is largely held here in the Maine Historical Society. And that is the story of the war in Wabanaki country. You know, what's now Northern New England, Southern Quebec, and even going into the Maritimes. And this war spread to all of those places. And yet, it is often completely off the map when people talk about King Philip's War, right? So a lot of books about King Philip's War will focus exclusively on Southern New England, and that's in part because the war in Southern New England appears to end with the death of leaders like Wiedemu and Philip. So I'm gonna tell you a different story today. And today, I wanna start talking about that ostensible end of war. So I wanna start with the end of war, go back to the beginning of the war in the Northern Front, and then come back around to the end of the war here, okay? And I'm gonna read some passages from the book, and then I'll talk between as well. So let me start with this passage from a poem here that's from a commemoration in Bristol, Rhode Island. So, the literal and symbolic death of King Philip not only marked the ends of Puritan narratives, but became an iconic image for the birth of New England. And this is exemplified by the following passage, right?
and you can read it here. As Jean O'Brien has demonstrated, Metacom or Philip's death has been privileged in the narrative of New England settlement because it allows for the finality of extinction and eclipse, the replacement of Indians with settlers. In the place where once the Wampanoag leader found a resting place is now the lasting home of the New England people, found and founded by our fathers, the narrative granting legitimacy to colonial claims to land. Metacom's nobility and resistance are honored here only because both are contained within the past. The narrative conveys that indigenous resistance, although noble, is futile. The story of the formative settlement of New England, leading to the American Revolution in Boston and beyond, is born of this narrative of extinction. It moves forward, seeming progressively, from this moment of early but contained violence. Philip's Rebellion of 1676 seems like a natural and necessary precursor to the Revolution of 1776, part of the labor pains inherent in the birth of a nation and the subjugation of the wilderness. But here's the question that I ask. What happens to this clearly contained narrative if we consider the history of the wars, of which this was merely the first, with the general Indian nations? That's what the Mohegans called it. And that continued for nearly a century. These conflicts, which Kevin Sweeney and Evan Hefeli term the Anglo-Abenaki Wars, and that's a pretty recent name, continued until the end of what we usually call the French and Indian Wars, or even until the war that established the United States. Although narratives of the Indian War, which was what they called it back then, that mark its end with Philip's death have been persistent, the documentary record provides a different story, as all of the scholars that I know of Wabanaki history are well aware. And to honor a couple of those scholars who I know have worked here, as Tad Baker and John Reed observe, to many modern observers, the defeat of King Philip and his allies is seen as a historical inevitability, part of a continent-wide conquest of Native Americans by Europeans. And this is still them. Those who lived through the war knew English victory was by no means assured. And that's kind of the story that I'm going to tell here today. So, the reality is that on the very same day that King Philip was hunted down by Benjamin Church and killed in his homeland in Wampanoag country, a new series of raids erupted here in the north, right? So that war certainly did not end with the death of King Philip. And in fact, on August 11th, this is 1676, a man who was known as Simon led a raid here at Caskwak, right? Right here. This is where that raid happened. And Simon was originally from the lower Merrimack River in Pawtucket country here. And he was one of many people who went north and joined Wabanaki forces, right? And there were also many people who came as refugees to the north, not people like Simon who joined a resistance but were merely seeking sanctuary. And this is the story that I was most invested in telling, because we have stories in Wabanaki country, including up at Missisquoi, where my family's from, about these people who came north. And I really wanted to understand how that happened, right? And it's also a really important story of survival, not just of death. So Simon, before leading this raid, had just escaped prison at Cochico. Many of you know this place, Dover, right? Richard Waldron's domain, with his companion Andrew and Peter, and they say returned to join with the Eastern Indians on his escape. So the traitor Richard Waldron, who's really famous in these parts, had attempted to capture and forcibly employ these men in military service when they came in with the Panacook Sachem Wanalancet during peace councils that were occurring at Cochico in June. So they came in with the peace councils, but Waldron captured them because, as he said, they had a hand in the killing and capture of settlers there. So he put them in prison, and he planned to send each out in turn against the enemy while retaining and securing the other two to ensure their compliance. Instead of following Waldron's plan, these three men broke the jail, right? And then what happens is that Simon comes up here and rejoins the resistance. And on that day in August 11, he raids the settler Anthony Brackett's farm, which is right on the Presumpscot River, right near here. And he brought two men with him, and he pretended to be turning them in for cattle killing. So at this time, many of the colonial forces were actually compelling Native people to kind of turn on their relatives and turn them in, right? So he pretended to do this, but then instead he used this ruse to confiscate all of the weapons that were held in Brackett's house. And this was very much a strategic reversal in this war, because one of the things that started the war on the Northern Front was a blunder by both Massachusetts and local Maine settlers. As the war started in the summer of 1675, basically what they did was, in order to try to contain what was imagined to be movement north, they decided to try to confiscate the guns from all of the Native people from Nuichewanik, right, which is now South Berwick, to the Kennebec River. And this was a big mistake, because as the trader Thomas Gardner reported, not only did this completely undermine the relationships between the settlers in this area and the Wabanaki people who lived here with this incredible breach of trust, but by this time, Native men were using firearms almost exclusively for hunting. So people actually starved because of the arms being taken away that winter. And again, this is recorded in documents that are here at the Maine Historical Society. And so Simon enacts a reversal, takes the guns, but he also offers Brackett a choice, which was even then being given to many Christian Indians and other captive individuals to the South, to become servants, slaves, scouts, and informers, or to be slain. So he asked Brackett, whether he would rather serve the Indians or be slain by them, right? And not surprisingly, Brackett chose to become a servant, right? A captive, right? And this is also the story of how some of the settlers who become captives end up in these Wabanaki networks. But Simon's story offers a very important counterpoint to the many stories of imprisonment, execution, and enslavement that we see happening during this war. He represents one of the many Native people who found refuge and the possibility of continued resistance in the North. That same month, that trader, Thomas Gardner, reported the coming of diverse Indians from the westward, escaping violence and containment. And these included people who managed to get north because there were bounties for any skulking Indian slain or captured on the south side of Piscataqua River. So if you could get north, right, of the Piscataqua, you might find safe ground. And further north, the Jesuit Jean Algernon reported the arrival of 150 Abenaki people at Sillery, which is at the confluence of the Chaudière and the St. Lawrence, in October 1676, driven there, he said, by the cruel war with the English of Boston and of all New England. As the French, the Quebecois historian André Sevigny remarked, and this is my translation, at the death of Philip, manifold representatives of the insurgent tribes of the West came to take refuge at the home of Squando, which is what the English called this particular Wabanaki leader, thus strengthening Wabanaki resistance and linking all of the people of the East in common cause, a renewed strengthening of the coastal kinship networks, which had been devastated by both disease and dispossession. So this is really where this idea of the people of the East takes great strength. So this raid at Kaskawak initiated a whole new wave of warfare in the North, including raids on the trader Richard Hammond's post and the extensive Clark and Lake Garrison and trading post at Arosik, both on the Kennebec River, south of the vital Wabanaki town of Taconic. Wabanaki protectors also pursued an innovative tactic, which some of you may have heard of, the capture of English vessels, right? So you had Wabanaki men actually taking English vessels and ships, right, and using them in this war. Within several days, over 30 settlers in Maine were taken captive or killed, while survivors fled, even as colonial commanders pursued total containment in the South. In the North, the war had just begun. So, In order to also understand this raid, it's really important, as I said, to understand the place where it took place. And I want to talk for a minute about Kaskowhack. This is a place where Christopher Levitt, the English explorer, recorded meeting a whole variety of Wabanaki leaders here in this traditional meeting place, this traditional peacemaking place. One of the leaders that he met was the leader who was responsible for hosting him in this place, who he called the Queen of Quack. He didn't quite have his Wabanaki pronunciation of Kaskowhack. And here he quotes her and saying, and I'll read it since a little is cut off, "The woman or reputed queen asked me if those men were my friends." He's referring to the fishermen on the coast. "I told her they were. Then she drank to them and told them they were welcome to her country. And so should all my friends be at any time. She drank also to her husband and bid him welcome to her country too. For you must understand that her father was the sagamore of this place and left it to her at his death, having no more children." And so, of course, he has to give a kind of patrilineal inheritance, right, to her leadership. But the role of Songtsqua, or these incredible women leaders, this is not uncommon. She is not an anomaly, especially in agricultural places. So part of what this book does is try to recover some of that history of women's leadership. And particularly in places where planting was central, right, women were the ones who controlled that food source, right? So it wasn't just, you know, some altruistic idea of needing balance between the genders, although that is embedded in the oral traditions, but it also is very pragmatic. And one of the things that happens in this war is a war on women's planting fields. Now, one of the things that's important to understand is she's welcoming him as a role as a leader. Guests in her territory must be welcomed, and this is one of the things that Wabanaki leaders face. How do you incorporate the newcomers? How do you bring them into redistributive networks? How do you bring them into relationships of responsibility and reciprocity, right? This was a question. How do you do that? But one of the things that Levitt and other people seem to have misunderstood during that time is when she said that he was welcome to her country. She didn't mean he was welcome to take it, right? So one of her at least political descendants, if not direct descendants, was a woman named Warabita, who appears on deeds here in the Maine Historical Society up and down the coast, particularly in places like Kaskowhack, like Owaskawag, which is now Scarborough, and even a little further north. And she played a very important diplomatic role, too. And in this deed that I'm showing you here, which you can see on Maine Memory, she and her brother are granting George Munjoy the right to also plant on the Penobscot River. But this particular deed is important because it recognizes the planting ground and fishing places that are right there, right here on the Penobscot River, where George Munjoy would have the ability to live and plant in the middle of. And this is important because Warabita also sometimes on these deeds, like one in Scarborough, required settlers like the Alder brothers in Scarborough to not only allow her and the women around her to continue to plant, but also to contribute an annual bushel of corn as acknowledgement of their leadership and also showing their contribution as any Wabanaki family would have to make to kind of like what I would call the common pot. And interestingly enough, Warabita dies in 1675, right before the start of the war. Okay, so that's an important origin story to the war that a lot of people don't hear. Another origin story is thinking about the places that the reports from the war emerge. And one of my favorite places to talk about the beginning of the war is much further up than here at Kaskowhack, is Pamajawasset and Winnipesaukee. So one of the things that I do in this book is try to recover and emphasize Native accounts, right, of the war. There was a time when people thought there were no Native accounts. They exist. One of the ones that I feel is very important is an account by Samuel Numfo, who's from a leadership family. Right in the area where Simon was from, on the Pawtucket, and this is on the Merrimack River. And he, like James Printer, was a scholar who was trained in preparatory schools in Cambridge. So as you can see on the left, he not only was literate, but could write quite well and eloquently in English. And he was asked early on in September to make an expedition up north to try to find the sachem Wanalancet, who very deliberately chose a position of neutrality in this war. He led a large group of people up north, up the Merrimack River, to try to actually get beyond any of the fronts of war, to kind of sit it out. And Samuel Numpha was sent after him, all right, to ascertain where he had gone and what was going on with him. So Samuel Numpha's account talks about going from his home of Pawtucket, which is where Lowell is now, Lowell, Mass., and talks about with great ease going up through these trails that you see in red here, up to Pemigewasset, which is a very important Abenaki place up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, around where Plymouth, New Hampshire is today, and Winnipesaukee, which probably most of you know, right? And Winnipesaukee was a place that very, very few English people had gone, even though they knew very well about it. And in fact, Massachusetts made it the northern bounds of their claimed settlement. Ironically, most Massachusetts people had never even gone there. And Pemigewasset was all but unknown to English settlers. But Samuel Numpha talks about it as if he's just going, you know, to his grandmother's house. So no big deal. And when he gets up there, he hears news about Wanalantet, but he also hears news of the first raids that happen on the Northern Front. And he reports on them. And this is what he says. Whoops. So, when you look at this map of rivers and waterways, you can imagine news traveled swiftly up these rivers and trails to Winnipesaukee, where Numpha first heard of the raids on the coast. The people at Winnipesaukee told Numpha that today, two Indians came from Piscataway, 70 miles to the south, reporting on the exploits of a company of 10 Indians. They told us, he wrote, they killed two Englishmen and take one alive. They referred to a September raid on the New Hampshire settlement of Oyster River in Piscataquag, where warriors killed two men in a canoe and took an Irishman captive. There we go. I think that shows. Yep. Sorry about that, Bill. I'm sorry, it's an Irishman, so. They also had news of some more Indians who went out afore these from Ossipee. At Kaskawak, these warriors killed some English and brought two children and one maid alive. From Ossipee, 50 more were going out, but when Numpha asked his hosts where, they replied, "We cannot tell." In Numpho's account, the view of the first raids, which ignited the northern front of war, was from Winnipesaukee and Ossipee, not Falmouth, right, Portland. And it was not from Boston. A Wabanaki town at the confluence of the Saco and Ossipee Rivers. Ossipee extended upriver to Ossipee Lake, northeast of Winnipesaukee. Trails connected it to upper Saco towns, including the Pequawket Intervale, another really important planting place, and the coast, including here at Kaskawak. Just as Numpha could navigate between his home of Pawtucket and Winnipesaukee, Wabanaki protectors could also move covertly between coastal settlements and the upper towns. With no settlements or forts upriver, Ossipee was essentially beyond reach. And there's actually a great account at the same time the forces were going into Great Swamp in Rhode Island, where they burned Narragansett Fort. They were also planning a raid up to Ossipee and were stopped by the 4 feet of snow. They never got anywhere during the war, right? That one is rarely reported on, but it's very important. They could not access it. In nearly all other accounts of the first Casco Bay raid, and some of you will be familiar with this, the house of settler John Wakely, right? The details are personalized, reconstructed from the account of Falmouth militia commander George Ingersoll, who discovered Wakely's corpse amidst the remains of his charred house, and he reported it to Andrew Alger in Scarborough. The raid is portrayed as a horrifying assault on a domestic space. A planter brutally murdered, his pregnant wife scalped, two children killed, and three others taken, his aging parents seemingly crawling over the threshold as the house erupted in flames. Historian of Portland, William Willis, reflected, "Why this family was selected for a sacrifice, we have no means of determining." But again, I would turn us to the place here, and there's a lot of analysis I do in the book, but the one I want to most emphasize today is the place. So Viewing the raid from Ossipee, right, Samuel Numpho's account, enables a broader and more concrete perspective on the beginning of the war, and particularly this raid. So Ossipee's riverside trails led southeast to Amacongan, the planting grounds and fishing falls of Werribeeta and her brother Skittery Gusset. This was also the site, the very site, of the Wakely raid. The Wakely family had first settled on Back Cove, southwest of the Presumpscot River's mouth. I'm sure many of you know this place, along with most other Falmouth settlers. John was among the second generation of planters who sought the fertile ground that was upriver. Until the 1670s, no settler houses existed on the north side of the Presumpscot above Skittery Gusset Creek. John Wakely was one of only three men who built houses north of the creek between 1672 and 1675, just before the outbreak of the war. His house was only 3/4 of a mile below the Presumpscot Falls. This is the major fishing place, right? These houses are right on the planting grounds at Amacongan. And this is also where John Phillips had built the first sawmill. And both of those structures encroached on the village where Skittery Gusset and Werribeeta had lived with their extended family. So this raid was enacting the reclamation of Amacongan, right? And the fishing falls and planting grounds there. And not surprisingly, as Numpho's report suggests, this incident did not take place in isolation, but was part of a network of coastal raids. So at the beginning of September, and I'm going to outline some of these raids for you, Thomas purchases trading post and house on the Bajebscot or the Lower Androscoggin River. That was hit on September 15th. Three guns appeared out of the bushes, and two men fell in the marsh, shot down as they attempted to gather grass or salt hay from a Waskawag. And this is important because a Waskawag is the place of good grass. It is a sweetgrass gathering place that was being converted into pasturage for cattle. Several days later, Wabanaki warriors burned down 7 houses at Waskawag or Scarborough, including 2 second-generation Alder homes, and they killed Andrew and Arthur Alder, who had made that original agreement with Werribeeta. And this is important because according to the original deed, the Alders would quote-unquote suffer Werribeeta and her mother to plant in the field until the death of Werribeeta, which, as I said, occurred in 1675. So her descendants may have been attempting to reclaim those fields as well, particularly if both their usage rights and the acknowledgement were disregarded, terminated supposedly by this deed. And this continued on. Just south of Waskawag, Wabanaki protectors turned to the Saco Falls, and they struck at Mills. As trader and military commander Richard Waldron reported from Cochico on September 18th, 36 Indians came over the Saco River in English canoes, and which come ashore cut holes in them and turned them adrift. Then they went to Major Phillips' sawmill and set it on fire and did like to his corn mill. Right? And this gets fully reported on. And it's no coincidence that among the first raids were strikes on mills near traditional planting grounds and fishing falls, including Saco and Oyster River. So this was not surprising to me given what I knew of later Wabanaki wars and the motivations for striking. But at almost every turn, these raids were strikes on mills that were blocking the river. They were strikes on corn mills. They were strikes on places that were in the planting grounds, right? They were not random at all. And this is important to know that the mills were fed by the massive white pines. You know about these white pines. They grew huge in this land that were daily cut and harvested from the forests, logs carried downriver by natural water power. Settlers built over 50 sawmills on the Wabanaki coast by this time, producing up to 1,000 feet a day of white pine boards. The mills powered the local settlements, but the exports of lumber, fur, and fish produced by men like the Waldrons, Phillips, and other traders also fueled the Massachusetts colonial economy, providing the colony's major source of income. While supporting colonial growth, this intensive logging disrupted Wabanaki subsistence. It radically transformed the habitat where men hunted, it destabilized the riverbanks where women planted, and it impinged the fish that migrated annually for spawning, some already compromised by intensive commercial fishing on the coast. And this is, of course, exactly what led to Poland's resistance in the later decades, and his diplomacy going down to Boston to protest the dams on here, the Presumpscot River. And additionally, Phillips gristmill harnessed the river's power to grind corn from the lower Saco fields, which were now cultivated by English planters and plows. So the physical and symbolic act of burning the mills would be repeated on the coast throughout the war. This just happened over and over and over again. And they even started taking corn, right, from the settlers' fields, and taking them almost as a forced acknowledgement. Protectors also strove for rebalancing at the falls by targeting traders, including Phillips and Waldron. During the raid on Purchase's post on the Bajebscot, warriors evened the scales on his stores, taking what they liked without even asking the price of it. When previously, one Androscoggin man recounted, Purchase had once charged him £100 for water drawn out from Mr. P, his well. So Purchase was one of many traders who had a reputation for swindling Wabanaki hunters, which further undermined the social responsibilities and political relationships that were integral to Wabanaki ideas about trade. Although Wabanaki leaders had initially been willing to share coastal resources with small populations of fishermen, traders, and settlers, they quickly learned that this welcome had opened the door on a wave of settlement that had upset a balance they had maintained for millennia. So as I learned, not just from the records, but from talking with tribal historians here and in other places like Wampanoag territory, this war was about a rebalancing. That was the aim, to rebalance this situation that had gotten out of control. And the other motivation to take into account when we view this raid up from Ossipee, I'm going to go back to the map for a minute here, is that they were seeing what was happening to the South, Wabanaki people, including Wabanaki women. So part of the purpose of these raids are to keep the settlements to the South, to prevent those mills from coming upriver, to prevent the dispossession of the planting grounds that even at that moment women were harvesting from. Right? So this is part of the motivation for these raids. Okay. So I told you I'd go to the beginning and then come back to the end. So we're going to talk about the end. So as I mentioned, the warriors continued to raid places like these. Even after the death of Philip, Philip was in no way the leader of this war, even in the South. We were talking about that beforehand. This was a multi-tribal coalition of leaders, and so it continues on long beyond his death. And so part of thinking about the end of the war is thinking about two things besides this continued resistance that I'm talking about. It is the rise of diplomacy, a peacemaking process that was initiated on the Connecticut River and Mount Wachusett that continues as refugees come north, and which Wabanaki leaders were absolutely instrumental in making happen. And the incredible amount of captivity and enslavement of Native people. As other historians have written about way before me, the numbers of Native people who are taken into captivity and enslavement during this war far exceed the number of English people who are taken captive. And most of the English people are returned from captivity, and they're not taken very far, where many of the Native people are shipped down to Boston and then sent into slavery in the West Indies. And I was just talking with another writer here tonight about her family and other families who some of those families were actually able to reunite in recent years. The families from Wampanoag and Narragansett country who lost relatives were able to reunite with some of the families in Bermuda who retained those stories. And that's a phenomenal story. But one of the things that I try to do is track as many of these people as I can who are taken captive by men like Richard Waldron and really try to look at the documents that are here at the Maine Historical Society and in other places in other archives in Massachusetts that tell us the story of what really happened as near as we can get it from the documents. Right, even in his own documents, right, to see how that happens. But they were also holding Massachusetts accountable for the actions of people like Waldron who were taking orders and giving orders up here on the coast. And Madame Scarbe was only one of the speakers for this letter. It's quite a long letter, and also Elizabeth Hammonds herself is a really interesting figure. And she was treated pretty badly by Waldron herself, so she had good motivation here as well. So speaking for the Kennebec River people and their allies, the Wabanaki leader Moxis told Governor Leverett in this same letter, "We would find your mind," conveying that you find us always for peace. He used poetic oratory to express both the still state of their collective mind, and I use stillness here. This is based in the language and the idea of peacemaking is cultivating stillness, right? And you see this in the records of the peacemaking, where not just Wabanaki leaders, but other native leaders are using this language of calm and stillness, of renewing that state of mind. The still state of their collective mind focused to follow all ways, that is, paths to peace. And their integrity, they talked about their integrity in previous and present councils, advocating always for peace. They sought to engage in peacemaking once more, offering to resume the trade, and trade really equals peace here, and the return of 20 English captives, whom Hammond could attest they had treated well. Moxis also offered a distinction between themselves and warriors like Simon, who had led a spring raid on York and Wells, and the Wabanaki leader Mog, who had died in a raid on Black Point, and others of the Saco, Presumpscot, and Androscoggin River who continued to raid English settlements. But they acknowledged that this violence arose in response to colonial actions, including Waldron's deceits. Such deceits had also marked English overtures towards peace. Recalling the Waldron's and Massachusetts men's actions, they proclaimed, "You always broke the peace." This time, they insisted, they would have to see evidence of the colonists' commitment to cease violence and renew the trade first before they would release more captives. They must have known the leader Shoshonim of the Nipmucks had been betrayed even as he sought to fulfill the restoration of captives. This is something that happened to the South that they knew about. The Kennebec Sagamores requested that Massachusetts send both material and symbolic evidence of its peaceful intent and commitment, goods including tobacco and corn, as well as powder and cloth, and that they would return the captives they had taken at Pemaquid. Still, the most important message the Kennebec sachems conveyed was the firm ground from which they offered the possibility of peace. "We can fight as well as others," Moxis proclaimed, "yet we are willing to live peaceable. We will not fight without they fight us first." Emphasizing this point, Madame Scarbe, this is the other leader, the spiritual leader, recalled, "We were quiet when they came to take away our guns, and our desire is to be quiet once more." So they desired and cultivated the restoration of stillness and right relations. And Madame Scarbe recalled the actions by men under Massachusetts jurisdiction that fostered imbalance, dispossession through drink, he talked about, the confiscation of guns, which I mentioned earlier, false assertion of blame for damage to cattle by wolves, so they were blaming Wabanaki men for damage to cattle by wolves, the manufacture of debt for small infractions, like he said, "We must pay 100 skins if we break a tobacco pipe," and binding and imprisoning the people, which Madame Scarbe described as akin to death. "And now," he said, "we hear that you say you will not leave war as long as an Indian is in this country." Madame Scarbe's statement revealed Wabanaki people's ability to read the landscape through a wider lens than Massachusetts settlers could possess. The Kennebec leaders sent their message after Waldron's botched attempt at containing the Northern Front in February 1677 under orders of Massachusetts. And what's interesting, this order still exists, but in Massachusetts' reply to the Wabanaki sachems, they did not acknowledge their role, right? So they kind of like blamed it on Waldron and messing up. Waldron's killing and seizure of Penobscot leaders and their kin at Sagadahoc had only fueled the fire, spreading it further east. His deceits also fueled warriors led by Squando and Simon, triggering further raids and moving the Northern Front closer to Cochico and Boston. At one point, one of the Wabanaki leaders said that they're going to take Boston next, right? So this was very serious at this time. Further, before the Kennebec, and he also made a quote-unquote diplomatic visit to Boston to scout things out. Further, before the Kennebec message arrived, Massachusetts had pursued another disastrous expedition with Waldron to seek out, quote, the headquarters of the Eastern Indian enemy. And military support at this time was denied by both Plymouth and Connecticut. They didn't want to be involved on the Wabanaki front. So through John Pynchon, Massachusetts had also tried to renew their friendship with the Mohawks, asking them with three wampum belts to pursue our Indian enemy at Kennebec and as far as Canada. And the problem with this was that the Mohawks weren't interested in doing that either, and they ended up going after the Christian Indian allies of Massachusetts instead. This news, all of this news, traveled quickly with Native people to the missions on the St. Lawrence. This is what you're missing, is the big map. So I encourage you to go to the website to see our lovely big map of this territory. So this news goes to the missions on the St. Lawrence, and then down through Wabanaki villages on the Chaudière, all the way to the Kennebec. And the displacements caused by war, Native people going up to the missions because of the war, then fueled the communication networks, right? And from knowledge of these actions, this is where Matt Oscar Bay's accusation comes from, that Massachusetts sought to fight until not an Indian remained. Yeah. So he could not just clearly see past injustice, but also Massachusetts' current policy of total containment, destruction, and replacement. Yet Matt Oscar Bay insisted that this desire would not be fulfilled, declaring, "We are the owners of the country, and it is wide and full of Indians, and we can drive you out." He could see the vastness of this country and the people who belong to it, from the coast to the great river of the St. Lawrence and the long river of the Connecticut, even to the new intertribal town of Scaghtikoke, sheltered under the great tree of the Mohicans and New York Colony. Massachusetts, despite its boasts, patents, and deeds, could not rightfully claim to be the owners. In his own language, Matt Oscar Bay proclaimed this land our country. In the Abenaki language, this is Ndakina. His statement evoked a sense of common identity throughout the region. In his language, Anobak, a word formerly meaning only human beings, transformed to represent Indians, those people indigenous to this country claimed by New England. The word also asserted the humanness of Indian people in contrast to colonial objectification. Combining these two potent words, Matt Oscar Bay evoked a sense of confederation among the people who had emerged through war as the Eastern Indians. The Wabanakiak and Wolpanak, that's Wampanoag, they're the same word in different dialects, whose name now took on new meaning in the wake of the war. Not only the collective people of the East, but those who belong to and would remain in this vast eastern land. So this war ends through this diplomacy. Kennebec leaders, and then New York comes in, right, on the colonial side to negotiate a peace. And I'm sorry that you cannot see it here. You can see it on Maine Memory. You can see it on our website. One of the most important and almost unknown documents of this war is right here at Maine Historical Society. And that is Joshua Scotto's account of the Treaty of Pemaquid, which is the treaty that actually ended this war. And that account comes only to us almost in fragments, right? Fragments in the New York colonial documents about New York's expedition, which luckily are quite detailed. Documents in Massachusetts with a communication that went back and forth both between Massachusetts and Wabanaki leaders and Massachusetts and New York leaders. And it happened at Pemaquid, this treaty. And what's remarkable is Joshua Scotto's account not only gives you a sense of what happened at the actual treaty council. So there were many, many councils, both in Wabanaki country and lower, where Massachusetts and New York were involved, that preceded the final one, right? Months of councils. And finally, one of the things that happens in that treaty is, first of all, there are equal terms, right? So equal ending of the war, return of captives, and most important, the commitment to the cessation of violence on both sides. And that when Massachusetts makes that pledge, it has to be for all of the English. They insist that it has to be all of the English. And the thing that makes this most important is because this is the treaty after which you see the violence stop, right? This is the treaty that ends the violence. And most important, this is also the treaty that brings back those people from Machias. And there, the Skato account includes an incredible account of two of the men, including Madoscar Bay, reaching below into the below the deck of the cabin, the sloop that Joshua Skato brought in, and bringing out a young boy, right, from the bowels of the cabin. This is also the treaty where the Penobscots come in and finally return some of the vessels. And the New York delegation in particular remarks on how generous that is because it was not originally part of the terms of the treaty, right? It's a remarkable document. It's here at the MHS, and it brings us a very different end to this war. And so part of the reason why I talk about this is because I want people to know that this research is not done. This is a war which many historians thought had been done to death, like there was nothing new to know about this war. And I want to say that it's just beginning. Okay. Thank you.